with an
Research Incorporated and Al Petitioners versus Edward J. Brenner, Commissioner of Patents. Mr. Dodds.
Mr. Chief Justice and Associate Justices, may it please the court. Fortunately, the factual situation presented by this case is somewhat less complex than the one heard at the conclusion of the session yesterday. Can be very simply stated, and this factual situation raises a single issue of law. As to the facts, an inventor by the name of Robert Regis made an invention on a microwave switch and filed an application in the patent office in 1957. Microwave switch is a device which is useful in connecting and disconnecting a microwave transmitter station from its antenna, as principally used, for example, in radar installations. However, since the subject matter is quite complex, the issues involved do not require going into the details of that device. Now, after that application was filed in 1957, and certain preliminary proceedings in the patent office, which are not material here, in 1959, the examiner of the patent office finally rejected the claims of Regis, saying, and I quote, as being unpatentable over Wallace in view of Carlson, unquote. And that is the Wallace patent 28-22-526 and 24, Carlson patent 24-91-644, reproduced in the record. That decision of the primary examiner was affirmed by the Patent Office Board of Appeals and by the courts below. Now, the respondent, neither in the Patent Office nor in the courts below, contended that either of these two reference patents, the Wallace patent or the Carlson patent, individually was an anticipation of the Regis invention. But what it contended was that if one were to combine the invention of Wallace with the invention of Carlson, then as an engineering matter, that combination would have been obvious and would have resulted in the structure defined by the claims in the Regis application. That would be all right, but for this fact, at the time that Regis filed his patent application, in 1957, the Wallace disclosure was found solely in an application which was maintained in secrecy in the patent office and was not available to Regis nor to any other workers in the art who at that time might have been attempting to devise the Regis microwave switch. The Wallace application and the resulting patent is what has come to be known in the jargon of the patent law as a co-pending patent. That is a patent which was filed before the patent on controversy, but did not issue until later, so that there was a period in which both the so-called reference patent and the application or patent under consideration were both pending in the patent office and both maintained in secrecy. Now, the respondent in this case relies solely on Section 103 of Title 35 United States Code, the 1952 Patent Act, and we'll have a little more to say about that later. And the respondent contends that notwithstanding the fact that the Wallace patent was at the time a secret application in the patent office, that it was, and I quote, prior art, unquote, as that term is used in Section 103, and therefore the invention or the disclosure of Wallace could be combined with, taken together with, that in earlier patents which were admittedly prior art to show that what Regis did was an obvious thing to do under Section 103 of the statute. Now, it is petitioner's position, however, that as a matter of law, the Wallace patent, as of its filing date, was not a part of the prior art as that term is used in Section 103 of the statute, and was not competent evidence to show whether or not what Regis did would have been obvious to that mythical man skilled in the art at the time that Regis made his invention. Therefore, the sole issue of law presented on this petition is whether such a co-pending patent, which is maintained in secrecy in the Patent Office until it issues, is a part of that general fund of knowledge come to be known as the prior art, as that term is used in Section 103 of the statute. Now, this Section 103 is the only section of the patent statutes which define what is termed conditions for patentability, which uses this term prior art. And it reads in part, if the differences between the subject matter sought to be patented and the prior art are such that the subject matter as a whole would have been obvious at the time the invention was made, at the time the invention was made, to a person having ordinary skill in the art. Now, at the time the invention made, as far as we're discussing here, was at the time that Regis filed his patent application. It had not been, there'd been no occasion for attempting to establish an earlier date of invention. Now, the statutes nowhere explicitly define this term prior art, but there were many decisions of the courts, the lower and superior courts, going back 100 years, which did define the term prior art. And in this case, there is also, we have some assistance from the report of the Committee of the Judiciary in reporting out the 1952 Patent Act. That report, and I've referred to it in the petitioner's brief, says that Section 103 was the first statutory statement of this particular condition for patentability, which has sometimes been referred to as defining what is invention, an elusive term. And that report said, Section 103 states this requirement of patentability in the title. It refers to the difference between the subject matter sought to be patented and the prior art, meaning what was known before, as described in Section 102. Now here we have a definition of prior art. It is meaning what was known before, as described in Section 102. But now it appears that Section 102, which defines most of the conditions for patentability, has seven subsections. But of those, only the first one, subsection A, uses this language, what was known before. And the committee report in discussing this section, 102A, again gives a definition of, quote, what was known before. And I quote again briefly, Section 102 in paragraphs A, B, and C repeats the conditions in the existing law relating to novelty. Subsection A, and that's the one we're concerned with, is the language of the existing law, recognizing that the interpretation by the courts excludes various kinds of private knowledge not known to the public. Continuing, the interpretation by the courts of paragraph A, and that's this section 102A, as being more restricted than the actual language would suggest, parenthesis, for example, known has been held to mean publicly known, end of parenthesis, is recognized. So summarizing this change, we find that in determining what prior art means under Section 103, it says what was known before as defined in Section 102. And we turn to 102A, and it says what was known before means what was publicly known before. So that in this instance, the Wallace patent that we're talking about, which was at the time that Regis' application was filed, a secret application in the Patent Office, was certainly not, quote, prior public knowledge, and we submit that it was not prior art available under Section 103 of the statute upon which respondent places sole reliance on this petition. In addition to the committee report to which I have referred, there have been many decisions over the years, many of them leading decisions, involving what the committee referred to as the interpretation by the courts, to the effect that prior knowledge, and that's used in Section 102, is limited to prior public knowledge. Those authorities are set forth and analyzed in the brief, and I won't repeat them at this time. Now, coming back again, the patent office said that Regis could not have his patent because the invention was unpatentable over Wallace in view of Carlson. Now, that is what known in the patent jargon again as a combination rejection. The disclosures of two or more patents or publications are considered together and combined together to build up a structure which is shown to be the equivalent of the structure which is being claimed. And whenever a rejection of that sort is being made, it is by the authority of Section 103, referring to one of the conditions of patentability, that the invention shall not have been obvious over the prior art. But, and I repeat, at the time that Regis made his invention, the Wallace patent was not a part of the prior public knowledge, and it was not a prior part of the prior art, and it could not be used to show, whether in conjunction with another invention, the invention of Carlson, to show whether or not what Regis did amounted to invention. We also submit, Your Honors, that the better reasoned decisional...
Excuse me, may I ask? Do you consider subdivision E of 102 to have any relevance to this question?
Your Honor, I definitely do not. And as a matter of fact, in my brief, I referred to a recent decision by the Court of Customs Patent Appeals, which said expressly that Section 102E had nothing, I'm sorry, that was 102B, had nothing whatever to do with 103. Well, but it's our position that 102E likewise has nothing to do with 103.
Well, on the face of it, that shall be entitled to a patent unless the invention was described in an application for patent by another filed before the invention thereof by the applicant for patent. On the face of it, it seems to fit this case.
Well, that would be true, Your Honor, if the Wallace patent or some insignificant variation of the Wallace patent showed the Regis invention. If that were so, we wouldn't be here. We recognize that. There's no question that the Wallace patent is a reference under, if it can be used under 102E, to show, and that section of the statute uses the word the invention, not some different invention. But here it is not contended that the Wallace patent shows the invention, and as a matter of fact, the district court, in its opinion, explicitly held that it did not. At page 70A of the record, the district court, in its opinion, said, neither the Wallace et al. Patent nor the Carlson patent alone anticipates the invention described in the claims in suit. Now, that's a finding of fact of the district court, which I believe has not been challenged, and I believe is binding on appellate tribunals.
So your answer is that it does not fit this case because the invention involved in the Regis patent was not
in Wallace.
In Wallace.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And Regis wouldn't infringe either Wallace or Carlson?
In neither, Wallace or Carlson. The only way that it would be possible to attempt to reconstruct Regis' invention was to add those two inventions together. Yeah. And on that has to become under Section 103, Your Honor. Now, I'd like to make a few comments on a respondent's brief. This 1952 Patent Act is a little odd in a way. The Section 102 has seven subsections, and Section 103 just a single section, but they all expressed negatively. They say that an inventor is entitled to a patent unless one of these, what they term conditions for patentability, is satisfied. Now, respondent in his brief cites numerous authorities under Section 102, which Your Honor referred to, or under the Alexander Milburn case of this court, which Section 102E codified, showing that a co-pending patent for that purpose was a proper reference, and we concede that is a fact. But they then, from that specific showing, attempt to generalize and say, well, the co-pending patent is relevant, as they say, relevant to patentability, because it was relevant under this one condition of patentability, but they attempt to extend that to all the other conditions of patentability, some of which are very clearly inapplicable because they just don't make any sense. And we say that as a complete non sequitur, the fact that because the Wallace patent may be a reference under section 102E, that it thereby automatically becomes a reference, and therefore, as they say, relevant to patentability under all of the other sections of the Act. And that the courts have not so held, and we don't believe it's logical to, and they're within the meaning or the intent of Congress in passing that Act. There is one other comment which I would like to make with respect to respondents' brief, and that is it repeatedly, what we believe, misstates the factual situation by reiterating the assertion that the Regis invention is but an insignificant advance over the Wallace patent. Now, we have just referred to that. If that were true, as Mr. Justice Brennan said, Section 102 would apply, we wouldn't, 2E would apply, and we wouldn't be here. But it is not true. In my brief, I have referred to some of these repeated statements which we believe are misstatements. For example, at page 29 of its brief, it states, now, if both Wallace and Regis patents were to issue, for example, a member of the public wishing to use the single patentable invention of Regis and Wallace, embodied in both, might have to obtain license from both patentees. And Wallace, the prior inventor, might have to obtain a license from Regis. But that is just not the fact. But that assertion, or its equivalent, is repeated. So, in conclusion, we submit that the court, the judgment of the court below, should be reversed first, because neither Wallace patent nor Carlson patent shows that Regis was not the first inventor under Section 102E. And secondly, Wallace patent is not a part of the prior art, which refers that general fund of knowledge available to those skilled in the art to determine whether the quantum, the amount of advance which Regis made over that prior art, amounted to a patentable invention. Thank you.
Mr. Doolittle.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This is one of several cases before the court this term involving the broad question of whether or not the lower federal courts have properly limited the award of the patent monopoly by maintaining adequate standards of patentability. This case differs from the others in that here, the courts below properly, we submit, resisted the applicant's efforts to lower the standards of patentability and thus to enlarge the patent monopoly. The precise question presented here is whether a co-pending patent is a relevant reference in determining whether an applicant has made a patentable advance in the art under Section 103 of the Patent Act of 1952. As Petitioner's counsel has indicated, Petitioner's position is that it is not so available, so that a patent could issue on an application, notwithstanding that an earlier filed co-pending patent had disclosed everything in that application except what is obvious to one skilled in the art. In other words, petitioners would allow a patent to issue on an application disclosing no patentable advance over a prior patent. And of course, that is exactly what this case involves. Petitioners having conceded that the advance which the Regis application made over the co-pending Wallace patent was an unpatentable, obvious one in view of the Carlson invention.
Could you speak a little louder, please?
Yes, Your Honor.
A little.
Now, counsel has focused specifically on the government's use of the word insignificant in referring to this advance, the advance that the Regis application made over the Wallace application. Perhaps it would be a good idea to say insignificant for purposes of the patent laws, because the fact is the advance was an unpatentable advance in the eyes of the patent laws because, as is universally conceded, it was an obvious advance. Now, I should like to pause for a moment.
Did the courts below use the word insignificant?
No, they didn't, Your Honor. No, they didn't. It's, as I say, when we say insignificant, we mean insignificant in view of the patent laws, unpatentable, an advance that could not serve as the basis for a patent.
That's begging the essential question, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, it isn't in the sense that an obvious advance is an unpatentable advance, and you have to make a qualification on that general concept in order to come out the way petitioners would have you come out. In other words, you have to say, well, we're going to make an exception. We're going to give a patent for an unpatentable advance or for what would otherwise be an unpatentable advance in this instance because, as I say, it is an advance that is universally conceded to be an obvious one, which Section 103 says...
It's not a patentable departure from the prior art. It's not patentable, but something that is.
But it is a patentable advance. It is an unpatentable advance over a prior patent. There are going to be two... If a patent is issued, there are going to be two patents available, one of which is going to be an obvious one in light of the other one. That much
well,
can't be disputed.
In light of the other one and something else.
Well, it is the something else that makes it obvious, but you're right, it is the combination of the two. But the fact is that there are going to be two patents that where the difference is obvious between the two. I would like for a moment just to try to place petitioner's position in its proper context. Now, petitioners recognize that a co-pending patent is available to show a disclosure identical to the disclosure of the application in issue. However, petitioners would make a co-pending patent unavailable where its disclosure is not identical to that of the application, but where the difference in disclosures is so insubstantial as to be obvious to one skilled in the art. Second, petitioners recognize that all other references that are available to show identical disclosures are also available to show obviousness. The petitioners would single out this one kind of reference, co-pending patents, for special treatment. And thirdly, petitioners recognize that if the co-pending patent here had issued just 2 months earlier than it did, that is, after 3 years and 8 months in the patent office, rather than 3 years and 10 months, the disclosure of the Regis application would have been unpatentable. Their contention is that the passage of these 2 months rendered the disclosure in that application patentable. We submit that this position is contrary to both the letter and the spirit of the Patent Act and should be rejected by this court.
Mr. Doolittle, I'm not...
Beg
your pardon.
Go right ahead.
I'm not sure that I quite understand whether your statement of petitioner's position is in fact petitioner's position. In making the distinction of 102, in distinguishing 102E, I thought it was petitioner's position that the article here would be patentable if you consider only the Wallace invention, and that petitioner's point is that considering Wallace in view of Carlson, there's no invention here, but that if you consider Wallace alone, that this was a significant advance in terms of the Patent Act.
Well, Your Honor,
I'm not sure that I have...
As I understand...
I'm correct about this, well, but I did get a different impression of petitioner's position.
As I understand petitioner's position, it is, and this, what I am stating is not only petitioner's position, but the government's position as well, that the Wallace application, the Wallace patent, did not fully disclose the Regis disclosure, and therefore Section 102E is not, strictly speaking, applicable. We do not contend otherwise. But that is not to say that the Wallace patent by itself, well, I'd strike the by itself, but that the Wallace patent does not render the Regis application unpatentable. You can't take it out of the context of the fact that The Carlson patent was already on the books. It was available to the to those skilled in the art, and knowing what they knew because of the existence of the Carlson patent, they knew that the it would be obvious to go from the Wallace disclosure to the Regis disclosure. But it's true that neither Wallace nor Carlson, in and of itself, just all by itself, made the disclosure of the Regis application, and for that reason, we do not rely on Section 102E. Mr. Chief Justice, I thought you had a question. I'm sorry. Now, the basic doctrine on co-pending patents was initially set forth by this court in the Alexander Milburn case, which counsel for the petitioners have already referred to, a 1926 decision of this court, in which Mr. Justice Holmes declared for a unanimous court that co-pending patents are available references on the issue of patentability. Now, that case involved a co-pending patent that made an identical disclosure, but the reasoning of the court applied equally to co-pending patents whose disclosures rendered an application obvious. Thus, the court emphasized the irrationality of penalizing a prior applicant and rewarding a subsequent applicant for the delays of the patent office, a consideration no less applicable where the prior application fully discloses the invention than it is where it discloses enough to make the invention obvious. That no distinction could be drawn between these two kinds of disclosures was authoritatively settled by this court in Detrola Corporation against Hazeltine Corporation in 1941. That's 313 U.S. There the court, in our judgment, expressly ruled that co-pending patents disclosing all but the obvious are available references on the issue of patentability. We've discussed that case at pages 14 and 15 of our brief. You'll notice at the bottom of page 14, the portions we quote, the court specifically says that co-pending patents are among those that constitute prior art. And then on page 15, the portion that we quote makes it clear that the court was focusing not on the question of identical disclosure, but on the question of obviousness. Note the final phrase, since his advance over the prior art, if any, required only the exercise of the skill of the art. That, we submit, is a clear statement that the court was speaking in terms of the obviousness issue, that is to say, the Section 103 issue as opposed to the Section 102 issue. Now, among the lower courts, while there was a certain amount of confusion over terminology, the great majority of the lower court decisions rendered between the Milburn case and the 1952 Act were in accord with the Detrola decision. Now, one of these 1952 cases does deserve special mention, we think. That's Western States Machine Company against S.S. Hepworth Company, a 1945 Second Circuit decision rendered by Judge Learned Hand, as discussed at pages 16 to 18 of our brief. There, Judge Hand not only expressly recognized the Detrola case as settling the availability of co-pending patents to show unpatentability for obviousness, but he painstakingly explained why there is no rational basis for treating co-pending patents differently, depending on whether they make an identical disclosure or one that makes the application in question obvious. Thus, as of 1952, it had been authoritatively settled by decisions of this court and of the lower courts that co-pending patents are among the references available in judging obviousness. In that year, Congress enacted as a part of the Patent Act Section 103, which for the first time codified the rule that an invention is not patentable where the prior art, although not fully disclosing it, has rendered it obvious, and I quote, to a person having ordinary skill in the art, unquote.
Was there enough disclosure of the Wallace patent to make the advance obvious to others?
Well, as the examiner put it, there was, in light of the Carlson patent. those are the words that the patent examiner used, and that those essentially are the words for purposes of this case, petitioner has agreed to adequately describe the situation. Yes, Your Honor.
There was no disclosure, that is, no public disclosure of the Wallace patent, was there?
No public disclosure.
It was secret.
Well, it was secret until it issued.
Well, that's what I was referring to. Was there any any public disclosure
as of the time
bear upon obviousness?
As of the time that the Regis application was filed, of course, the Carlson application had it. The Carlson patent had issued.
Yes, that I
so know. that much of the art was familiar. But and was public knowledge. But it is a fact as to which there is no serious question that as of the time that the Regis application was filed, the disclosures of the Wallace patent were secret. They were maintained in secrecy under the rules of the patent office. Now, we believe that it is clear.
If I may interrupt you just once more, how does that square with the statement of the examiner that you just mentioned, that there was sufficient disclosure of the Wallace patent when taken in connection with the Carlson patent to put them on notice?
Well, of course, I might say, as of the time that the examiner made that statement, the Wallace patent had already issued. But of course, the question is not whether or not the petitioner, or I should say, whether or not the applicant, was on notice. The patent laws are not concerned with questions of notice. I shall develop more fully.
I thought that the prior art did depend upon general knowledge and the knowledge of people through publications or through patents that this was the prior art.
Well, we agree that, as described in Section 102A, that does generally describe the public knowledge of which patentees are on notice, whether they actually know of it or not.
Yes.
But we also contend that the patent laws require that in this instance material that could not have been known to the patentee, to the applicant, is chargeable against him in order that dual patents not issue on essentially the same material or on material that does not differ in any patentable way. Of course, if there is a complete disclosure, if the Wallace patent had completely disclosed the Regis application, petitioner would agree the Regis application could not have issued, and yet Regis would not have known of it as of the time he filed his application. Now, we're just saying that
that'd be by force of subdivision E.
102E, that's right, Your Honor.
And I'm just wondering how that can place it, that there is it. Explicit E that would cover that situation and how that supports your position.
Well, I'm simply saying that under the way in which the patent laws are set up, basically, as I was really about to develop, Section 103, we believe, incorporates the references of Section 102. The face of Section 103, in fact, refers to Section 102. And the legislative history makes it clear that 103 is referring back to 102. It doesn't say it's referring back to 102A, which is the way petitioner would read it. They would say the only part of 102 that is incorporated is 102A. Nothing about that in the statute or the legislative history. The references are to 102 generally. And we say the intention was clear that it would include other subsections of 102, including 102E. And of course, as of 1952, as I've indicated, the courts had held that co-pending patents were prior art for purposes of determining obviousness.
What was the date of Judge Hand's?
1945, Your Honor.
That's Western State.
Yes, sir.
Do you need make this point about 102E? Why doesn't 102A get you as far as you need to go?
Because 102A is generally considered as covering things that were publicly known.
Well, I don't know why it should be. When it says the invention was known or used by others, it doesn't say that it, if I know something, I can still know it and not tell anybody else. And if I can use something, I don't need to tell anybody else.
In fact, of course,
I could have a trade secret, a secret process, and be using it and knowing it, nobody else knows about it.
Well, of course...
I don't know why that wouldn't be a decent part of the prior art, though, wouldn't it?
In fact, of course, we don't rely on 102E. We rely on 103 and simply say that a co-pending patent is a part of the prior art.
But you're saying that the reference of prior art in 103 includes 102E. And I was just wondering why you needed to have any reference other than subsection A.
Well, the known part of it, of course, would not be satisfied with a co-pending patent. I don't suppose the used part of it would if there was no use other than the filing of the application.
Well, the invention was known. It certainly was known by the people who...
Well, it was known by the people who actually filed the application. That's right, Your Honor. Let me just say, out of an abundance of caution, we're relying primarily on Section 102. Well, on 103 as incorporating co-pending patents, which are covered in 102E specifically.
That means you do not rely on the other section?
We do not, Your Honor.
Uh-huh. Cases are all against you on 102A. Good reason you don't rely.
Now, as I began to say to Mr. Justice Brennan, Your Honors, as of 1952, the decisions of this court had established without any question that on the issue of obviousness, co-pending patents were available references. And we do not believe that it can be easily assumed that Congress would have abrogated those decisions without specifically saying so. Quite the contrary, of course, Congress made it quite clear in enacting the Patent Act of 1952, and specifically with respect to Section 103, that it was intending to codify existing law, both statutory and decisional. Now, in the years subsequent to 1952, the Court of Customs and Patent Appeals has consistently ruled that co-pending patents are available references under Section 103. And, of course, the District of Columbia Circuit, on meeting the question for the first time in the present case, has adopted that view. Now, petitioner has placed great emphasis on the alleged unfairness of using as a reference a co-pending patent of which an applicant cannot have been aware when he filed his application because of the secrecy accorded patent applications. This argument, we believe, misconceives the essential nature of the patent laws. The public does not give patents as a prize for cleverness or even ingenuity. It bestows a monopoly in exchange for a measurable benefit to the public in the way of an advance in the useful arts. And plainly enough, an invention that has been rendered obvious by a prior co-pending patent is of no benefit to the public, irrespective of whether or not the applicant himself may have known about it. Thus, the test of patentability is not whether an applicant subjectively believes or has reason to believe he has made an invention, but whether the invention represents a significant advance over the art, objectively viewed. This objectivity of the patent laws is manifested in a number of ways. An applicant is charged with knowledge of all of the vast literature in the field, including obscure foreign publications, of which he couldn't possibly be expected to have knowledge. An applicant who has conceived a truly inventive idea through a genuine stroke of genius will be denied a patent if someone else had the idea unbeknownst to him just a day or two before. And as petitioners concede, an applicant will be denied a patent if a co-pending patent, of which he could not possibly have been aware because of its secrecy, fully disclosed his invention. In short, we see no place for an argument that it is unfair to reject an application that discloses no patentable advance in the art, and hence cannot bestow any benefit on the public. Frankly, if there is an issue of fairness in this case, we believe it is the public interest in the due circumscription of the patent monopoly that would be dealt with unfairly if petitioner's view were to prevail.
What if Wallace hadn't filed for a patent at all? He just started using the process, but it was a secret process. Then the same question comes up, whether this, what's this fellow's name? Regis. Regis files for a patent gets a patent issued, and then finds out that that Wallace is using he sues somebody for infringement, and then it's claimed that that his patent is invalid because Wallace was using the process which would make his patent obvious.
Well, Wallace,
do you have the same question?
Well, Wallace would certainly be in a position to contend, of course, that he was the first inventor and to get get a patent granted on that account.
I'm just wondering whether secret processes, trade secrets that are being used prior to, are part of the prior art. Secret processes that someone is using as part of the prior art.
I'm afraid I don't have the answer to that, Your Honor.
It should be a similar question, shouldn't it?
Well, certainly in the sense of whether or not one has to be aware of the prior art, it would present the
same. Or even have an opportunity to be aware.
Yes, Your Honor, that's right.
Didn't quite understand your answer.
Well, I simply said that the questions are similar in the sense that in both situations there is some prior art or some prior use or what have you, of which the applicant would have no way of discovering.
Yes, but the questions are entirely dissimilar, are they not, the way you present the case. You rely exclusively, as you told the Chief Justice, on 102E. And by hypothesis, Mr. Justice White's question,
well,
there was no application.
We rely on Section 103, Your Honor, but...
As it refers to 102E.
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's still an answer. I don't understand what answer you gave, Mr. Justice.
Well, the specific answer I gave was, as far as a secret process, I expressed my doubt that on the issue of patentability, other than determining who was the first inventor, I expressed my doubt that would preclude the issuance of a patent.
Without regard to what the cases might hold in this field, doesn't your argument give a sort of distorted view to the meaning of obvious?
Not at all, Your Honor.
How would it be obvious to a man if he had no way, if there was no possible way that he could find out what the art was?
Well, of course it would not be obvious to him since he couldn't be aware of it.
Or to the
but
public, or to anyone.
As I have said, the patent laws operate in terms of objective advances in the art, not in terms of what a person in and of himself could know at any given time. And I've given a number of examples in which the patent law resembles exactly that. For example, we've just talked about Section 102E itself. Is it any less fair to say that when there is another patent, another application pending, of which the applicant could not possibly have known, where that fully discloses his patent, his invention, that the applicant is not entitled to the issuance of a patent? And yet that is exactly what Section 102E does demonstrate.
I would think it might be on another theory, but not on the theory that it's obvious.
It's not on the theory of obvious, but on a theory that's identical. It's more than obvious. It's identical. And we simply say that there's no reason why that same rule shouldn't apply to the invention that is rendered obvious by what has already been filed. We believe that petitioner's view to the contrary would allow a patent to issue for what must objectively be recognized as an unpatentable variation on an issued patent. And to that extent, we believe the standards of patentability would be clearly lowered. Applicants would reap completely undeserved and fortuitous windfalls as a result of the delays inherent in the patent application process. And we believe that users of inventions would be faced with the possible necessity of obtaining multiple licenses for the same invention. Indeed, we believe that prior patentees would even have to obtain a license to practice obvious variations on their own patents. Now, petitioners have indicated the contrary. However, we believe that if Wallace, we believe first that Wallace was entitled to practice obvious variations on his own patent, and that he was entitled to sue for infringement of anyone who made an obvious variation on his patent. And that would certainly include the Regis application, the Regis invention, under the agreed facts of this case. We believe there is no question but that Wallace would have been entitled or would be entitled to sue for infringement on the Regis patent or the Regis invention, unless, of course, a patent should issue. And if a patent should issue, that would mean that Wallace, an inventor, would have to get a license in order to practice variations on his own patent that all other patentees are allowed to practice as of right. Finally, we believe that the effect of petitioner's position would be that the patent monopoly on the invention, including its obvious variations, would be extended beyond the period allowed by the statute. It seems clear to us that such a view cannot be squared with the essential purposes of the patent laws. And for these reasons, we urge that the judgments below be affirmed.
Mr. Dodds?
Your Honors, I think we have a few minutes. There's one point I should like to take up initially, and I believe there has been a bit of confusion unwittingly introduced. As I understood, the position of the counsel for a respondent was that they were relying on solely on Section 103, but wanted to incorporate into that certain sections of 102. But I say to read 103, that does not permit that. What 103 says is this: even though you cannot get a patent, even though you can get a patent under 102, still, if the differences are not enough to amount to a patentable invention, as such have been obvious in the, one skilled in the art at the time the invention was made, there's an additional reason why you can't get a patent. But nowhere in 103 is there any intent to incorporate 102 as to what is within the scope of prior art. The introductory phrase says you refers to 102 only in the case that even though the 102 is not a bar, still you may not get a patent if it was obvious
that
over the prior art.
What you're saying is that 102 lists a number of conditions under which you can't get a patent.
Yes, sir.
And 103 just adds still another one. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly the point, Mr. Justice Brennan. I think that's exactly our position.
Well, what do you think prior art means? When Congress referred to prior art, when an invention has to be non-obvious over the prior art, what was the reference of prior art?
Prior art and the decisions which we have discussed and analyzed in our brief.
Why didn't Congress mean by those words what the cases said it meant?
Because precisely, Ryan, and the cases have always said precisely that prior art means what was publicly known. It's that general fund of technical knowledge.
You don't
knowledge.
Think there were any decisions prior to 52 that said a co-pending patent was part of the prior art?
Yeah, unfortunately there were, as there were decisions both. There were decisions both ways. There was considerable conflict, and there was even more conflict before the decision of this court in the Alexander Mildren case. Because then they turned, before that, some of the decisions tried to draw a still further line of distinction.
You don't think Detrola is really relevant to this case?
Pardon?
You don't think Detrola really has any bearing on this?
I think Detrola has no bearing on the case. I was coming to that, and the reason for that is this. As I referred in my in our briefs, if you look at the record and the briefs in the Gotola case, the position was solely that the invention there involved was shown not to be the prior invention of Wheeler, but it was shown to be the inventions of other people. Now, it is true that the words prior art were referred to, they were used in that case. But in the portions that I quoted in our brief, as pointed out, that they were not using them in the same sense that we're talking about here, nor were they using them in the sense that Section 103 uses them. They were using them as a general phrase in lieu of sometimes what is called synonymously anticipation. Anticipation embraces all.
Wasn't the regular practice of the Patent Office prior to 1952 to include co-pending patents in the prior art?
No, Your Honor, it was not.
The government's just wrong in saying that.
We think the Patent Office was wrong, but they did the Patent Office even before the 1952 Act.
The Patent Office now doesn't know what they were doing in 52.
They have maintained since the 52 Act, the Patent Office still maintains the co-pending patents as far as prior art.
And it did before. And it did before 52.
And they did before 52, mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
Now, one other point. As I understand it, the respondent would have the court believe that the addition of the Carlson invention to Wallace was an insignificant one. We think that is not right. There's nothing to indicate that the Carlson invention itself was not a significant invention. And therefore, the addition of Carlson's invention to the invention of Wallace cannot, in any sense, be termed an insignificant variation over Wallace. The question, as I pointed out in my brief, there are cases where under Section 102E, quite properly, the co-pending patent did not have everything, but there were some insignificant variation. I used the respondent's position, such as a particular kind of a cabinet or a support, or perhaps the use of gears instead of pulleys, where it is not necessary to add the invention of somebody else to build up an anticipating structure. But that isn't the situation we have here. Counsel for a respondent also referred to the question of fairness, which we introduced in our brief, and asked the question, is it less fair to deny an inventor a patent under Section 102E because of a co-pending patent of which he could not have had knowledge than it is here? And the answer is very clear. In the situation of 102E, or as presented by Alexander Milburn case, if a patent had been granted to the later inventor, even though he had no knowledge of the co-pending patent, he would then have been in a position to take away the right of the actual prior inventor from using his own invention if a patent had been granted to the second applicant, of which even though he had no knowledge. So it has become a question of fairness as between the first inventor and the second inventor. Somebody maybe has to be hurt. It seems fairer to hurt the second inventor than the first inventor. But that isn't true here. If patent is granted to Regis, nothing is going to prevent Wallace or his assignees from using his invention.
Well, Mr. Doolittle disagrees with you, I think. He says that Wallace would have to get a license from Regis.
That is definitely, there's absolutely no authority or no logic for that.
Did I misunderstand his contention, do you think?
I beg your pardon?
You think I misunderstood Mr.
No, I think he did take that position. I agree with
I
you.
I
but we just hardly disagree with it.
Yeah,
the point is, the claims that we're talking about here in Regis, which are before this court for a decision, everybody, the patent office, everybody says they are not the Wallace invention. They say that the district court said explicitly that the Regis invention is not unpatentable over Wallace alone. It's for a different invention. And if Wallace built his device, and particularly in view of the rulings of the patent office in Regis, he would not require any license from Regis, nor would Carlson. And moreover, Your Honors, when the Wallace patent and the Carlson patent expire, the public is then free to use the inventions disclosed in those patents without any charge of infringement by Regis, should the claims be granted to Regis.
Is there an area in which a prospective user of this invention would have to obtain a license from both Wallace and Regis?
Very definitely, Mr. Justice Waters. Wallace patent and the Carlson patent are earlier, sometimes what we call dominating patents. And if they broadly claimed what they had, and if Regis is the combination of those two inventions, Regis would probably have to have a license under both Wallace and Carlson in order to practice his invention. And that's common.
And a licensee, a person wanting to use the invention, wanting to practice in the field of the art, would in some area have to obtain a license from two of them, or perhaps three.
Of earlier, and perhaps others. And that's a general principle in the patent law, that a later improvement patent is always subject to any earlier, broader, dominating patents which may form a part of the invention of the later patent.
Is that true in this case?
Sorry.
As a matter of fact, is that true in this case?
That's certainly true in this
case. That Regis will have to have if he gets the patent, he will still have to have a license from Wallace.
That is true in general, I might suppose.
I know, but in this case.
Well, frankly, Your Honor, I haven't studied the claims of Wallace and Carlson to see just what they were claiming. As you are familiar, whether or not you can require a license or be charged with infringement depends upon the scope of the claims.
Yes.
Sometimes, but assuming that those men had patent claims in their patent, conventional with their invention.
Well, it could be anyway that Regis doesn't get that Regis's invention is obvious and non-patentable, it could be that he would get his patent because his invention was not obvious, and still he wouldn't have to have a license from Wallace.
It could be, but if Wallace and Carlson properly claimed their inventions, Regis would require licenses from the owners of both of those patents in order to practice his invention, but not the converse, as the counsel for respondent.
Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.